This episode of the UAV Digest is sponsored by GoEngineer, provider of design, engineering, and 3D printing solutions for the aerospace and unmanned vehicles industries. To learn more, visit the UAVDigest.com/GoEngineer. You're listening to episode 309 of the UAV Digest. I'm Max Flight in Hartford, Connecticut.
And I'm David Vanderhoof in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. Hello, everyone. Hopefully you had a good Thanksgiving, I must admit we're recording this over coffee this morning on the Tuesday before, but hopefully everyone had a good Thanksgiving, and we've got an interesting show. I know the first story gets me excited.
I know. When I saw that, I said, this is a story for David.
So for our topics this week, we've got a Star Wars nerd alert. I prefer the term geek, but okay.
Do you know, I just recently heard someone describe what's the difference between a nerd and a geek. They said a nerd wants to use a transporter and a geek wants to build a transporter.
Okay.
I thought that was a pretty interesting distinction. But sorry, continue.
Don't apologize. We're allowed to go on tangents on this show. We've got counter UAS testing at Dover, counter weed capabilities of drones. You twisted that title, didn't you? Because that was the reason why I liked that title also. Volcano watching, and from the Your Grounded Files, pull the checkbook out, you owe 20 grand. That's a big Your Grounded File story this week, but I think we should get started so we can start eating leftovers.
All right, David, let's get started.
Well, our first story comes from blogmickey.com, and I would like to say thank you to all of my listeners and all my friends who suddenly sent this to me, knowing that when my universe collides like this, I need to know. Unfortunately, it was a little overwhelming. But Disney is testing X-Wing drones to fly over the Star Wars Galaxy Edge parks. And these are not little drones, folks. They've been described the size of SUVs. So we're talking full-size X-Wings.
I guess there's a certain amount of speculation here, although there are some photos, some aerial photos, and an actual photograph of one of these X-Wing drones, which is a bit grainy. I don't know, maybe it was surreptitiously taken. But reportedly, Disney is testing a couple of these things to fly over this Star Wars Galaxy Edge. Is that the place that you went to?
I haven't been there yet. That's the new Galaxy Edge just opened up in Los Angeles at Disneyland and Disney World this summer. So it's on the bucket list. I haven't been yet.
But this is kind of a secret project for Disney, isn't it?
Well, I think the drones are a secret project.
Right.
We've talked about Disney and drones for a while, especially when the micro drones and as a supplement the fireworks. But of note, over both parks is a no-fly zone. But I'd like to thank Ben, one of our listeners to both shows, who pointed out to me that the TFR over in Florida is only over Epcot and the Magic Kingdom. Hollywood Studios, where Galaxy Edge is not part of the no-fly zone for Disneyland. So interesting that this is the way the Disney is skirting around their own TFR.
And there's images of a temporary tent that's been set up in a parking lot that's supposedly being used by the teams working on this project. But yeah, these things are really large. I'm curious to know what the power source is and just exactly how these things fly.
They have Tinkerbell in them, and the magic dust makes them fly. Don't you know how Disney works?
I should have known.
In all fairness, it's going to be interesting. Even the grainy photographs made this Star Wars fan a little obsessive Star Wars fan, swoon with envy. I have my best friend is going for his 50th birthday in January, and I hope he gets to see him. But, you know, yeah, Galaxy Edge will definitely be on the bucket list. If not 2020, it'll be 2021. So,
now, in this blog post, there's a comment or there's some speculation that these drones are only going to be used once, maybe just for this Rise of the Resistance media event. I don't know. It seems kind of strange that they would build and test and develop something so large and probably complex just to be used one time. I don't know. Any thoughts on that, David?
Well, Disney's done things like that before, but if it's a big hit, I'm sure they'll figure out a way of using them again and again and again. I mean, it would be really neat to see, like, your Galaxy event. I mean, Disney has a night show at various parks every night, you know, the Magic Kingdom, Epcot. I can imagine that this would be part of Galaxy Edge's night show. I'm sure that this secret, now that it's out of the bucket, we'll get more and more photographs on it. But it is pretty awesome that they are attempting this, and we'll see what happens. They've got a lot of excitement. If you haven't gotten Disney Plus yet, I suggest you do so. They have my money from now until the end of time. Just because The Mandalorian is amazing, and going back to watch some of the movies from my childhood, which most people probably don't remember who listen to the show, but things like The Cat from Outer Space or Escape from Witch Mountain, which were some of my very first science fiction movies. So it's kind of cool that you can go back in time and, you know, Sunday nights, Magical World of Disney. But let's move on to a little bit farther down the road from me, and that's Dover Air Force Base. It's ironically, this article about Dover Air Force Base was off of the McCord Airforce.mil website and news. Dover Air Force Base partners with Delaware CAP for counter UAS testing. Now, of course, the Air Force had to get so many initials into it, but if you don't know what CAP is, it is the Civil Air Patrol, which is the auxiliary of the United States Air Force. It will have its anniversary. It was founded on December 5th, 1941, a couple of days just before Pearl Harbor. But they're looking at it as working with the CAP to develop counter UAS at Dover, which is an interesting base to be doing it at.
Yeah, Dover. I've driven past Dover once many years ago with Drone Mama, and we kept seeing all these C-5A galaxies at low altitude. And we were a little concerned because we thought maybe we were observing some major news event that we weren't aware of. But as we got closer, we finally realized it was only one C-5A doing touch and goes. So we were relieved that we hadn't gone to war with somebody.
Being at Dover, I go on a fairly regular basis. And when I've driven down the Virginia Beach, I go by it. Seeing a pattern full of C-5s and C-17s is not your normal regular pattern of touch and goes. I mean, now Dover is, I don't want to say isolated, but it is fairly close to the Delaware River, the Delaware Bay, and it's a very flat area. You're dealing with an area where a counter UAS program would be a good place to test it out.
Right, and of course, military installations are one of the class of facilities that could possibly be threatened by drones. And so the U.S. military has an interest in protecting those kinds of installations. And we see here that the U.S. military is training and equipping to counter possible UAS threats. So there was some testing that was going on. Now, the article doesn't really provide a lot of details, but apparently this was at the Dover Operational Readiness for a Multi-Domain Agile Response Exercise that was just recently held. And the 436th airlift wing tested its counter UAS capabilities, system capabilities. But I don't know, David, they don't really describe what those are exactly.
Well, it's classified. They could tell you, but then they'd have to kill you. But it was interesting the way they rolled the CAP in, which is, and they were flying commercial drones with trained and certified pilots. The CAP were the adversaries, the counter air, and the threats for the base. So it's, you know, that kind of interesting mindset. CAP has been known to provide that kind of thing. Our friend Rod Roderick flies in the CAP, and quite often they act as aircraft targets for interceptions. Here, the CAP is taking a role of being the same thing, only but using UASs.
During this exercise, the Delaware CAP infiltrated the base, they say, using this commercial UAS, and the 436th employed some countermeasures to eliminate the threat. Again, we don't know what those countermeasures were, but apparently it was successful. They located and intercepted the UAS. So it's pretty exciting. And I imagine that this wouldn't be specific to this one base, David, that the countermeasure technology that they're developing and testing would be utilized at multiple bases.
Absolutely. I'm sure that it'll be spread out. The other part about it is there's a lot of lessons learned that can be taken away and deployed to the other bases, which is interesting because McCord is another very large base, Air Mobility Command base on the West Coast. So they have the same sort of strategic force structure as does Dover. So it's interesting, you know, how the Air Force can leverage this information and apply it to various other bases. But let's get down in the weeds now, Max. Let's go a little bit deeper. You know, you called me a nerd and a geek. Now let's talk about getting in the weeds. And this was from growingproduce.com. And in spite of the headline, it's not the weeds that you think. Drone tech takes weed control on the farm to a new level. So weed identification and mapping. We're talking precision agriculture again, and we've talked about watering, and we've talked about other things, but I don't think we've talked about weed management.
This article discusses some of the applications in agriculture. And yeah, the first group or category they talk about is weed identification and mapping, and they talk about the ability of drones to successfully measure weed density. An interesting statistic, drones are able to measure different weed species with greater than 90% accuracy. That's pretty good, it seems like. Also, canopy temperatures. Now, that's something that I wasn't really thinking about, but canopy temperatures can be used to identify different species that are resistant to treatment. And apparently there are different chemicals that are used for controlling weeds, and some weed species are resistant to certain chemicals. So drones can actually use the temperature of the weeds and identify them with greater than 95% accuracy. Now, the article does mention a couple of, well, downsides or a couple of difficulties associated with weed identification and mapping. One is that data analysis can take time. Obviously, there's a lot of data collected, a lot of crunching, a lot of analysis that is involved in identifying different weed species and all this this kind of identification and mapping. But they do point out that artificial intelligence may offer some relief, and that's an area that's kind of ripe for development. Using AI as part of the data analysis process in order to speed it up and get the results quicker.
I like how you got ripe in the precision agriculture article. But once you've diagnosed the weeds, Then what do you do? Well, you try to pull them, or in this case, spray them. So GPS semi-autonomous spray systems are being tested, hovering accuracy of 1 to 2 feet, and a lot of this has to do with things like spray drift patterns, impact of droplet size, the environmental health impacts of UAV-based herbicide applications. If you had a choice between a helicopter and a fixed-wing aircraft to spray herbicides, everyone would say a helicopter. Interestingly enough, the helicopter's better at doing it because the downwash from the rotor blades spreads the applicant over a wider area. But a manned helicopter cannot fly 1 to 2 feet off the ground. So this kind of precision herbicide could actually, and being able to hover over it, could be more targeted towards where the weeds are. But there are health impacts, you know. But a lot of the health impacts is, I guess it depends upon what you're actually spraying.
And it's kind of encouraging to me that the approach being taken here, at least in this article, is not, wow, this is great, let's go out there and start spraying stuff, but that we need to really understand those things you mentioned, David, like the drift patterns and the droplet size and all of those, because you're talking about application with a different device. And so you really want to understand it before you get out there and start using it to any great extent. And then another area they talk about is UAVs for aquatic weed management. And they say this is a common problem for Florida growers. And you've got water resources, but you can have weeds invade those water resources, and that can cause a problem. So drones can be used for mapping the invading species of weeds in water resources. That's the kind of a thing that's just really, really made for drones, so to speak. It's difficult to map and assess the water weeds by boat, or if you're on the shoreline and just observing it that way. So they note that UAVs can be used to detect new infestations. They can be used to estimate the biomass of the weed beds. And they can also be used to monitor the weeds before you treat them and after you treat them. And at the very end of the story, David, I thought this was kind of funny. They note that the information for the story was provided by the Weed Science Society of America. Who would have thought that there was something called a Weed Science Society of America? But there is. They're at WSSA.net. Boy, you know, I think there's a science society for almost everything you can imagine.
Yeah, there's a club for everybody.
Yes.
You know, as they used to say in high school, there's a place for everybody. You can get your nerd on or your geek on with everybody else. But this was definitely a fascinating article. Precision agriculture, we've talked a lot about, but there's a lot of aspects of it that we as people on the periphery don't think about. But here's another group of individuals that are thinking in depth and studying the value as well as what's involved with implementing drones into their cohort. So pretty interesting. Again, check out WSSA.net because, you know, they want to be loved as well, you know.
So I wonder if there's a volcano club, David.
Well, there's the Vulcan Science Academy. Oh, I'm sorry, that's Star Trek. I'm sure there is a volcano society. If anybody knows what the International Society of Volcano Studies are, or geologists, really is what it would be. I mean, volcanology is geoscience. But this was from the Hawaii Tribune Herald. Volcano Watch, Pondering the Pond. What Halima Uma Water Chemistry Tells Us.
And that's not David just sort of mumbling through the title. That's I can't read Hawaiian, David.
I only know a week's worth because of my trip there this year. But
But I think you did a pretty good job. Looking at this headline, I think you did a pretty good job. Tempting to pronounce it, but
he always loves throwing these curveballs at me, even though I found the story.
Yeah.
But the Hawaiian Volcano Observatory, HVO, used a multirotor to take samples of a water lake in a collapsed crater. The water has been rising a meter a week since July. The water's chemistry might tell where it came from, so the HVO wanted to sample it.
This is also very interesting, and I can imagine that you really want to be a little bit careful about taking water samples in a volcanic crater. And what's happened here, this is from an area that's been very active, and as the lava lake drained away only just last year, they expected groundwater to come in and fill in the crater. Which is something that apparently happens with some frequency. And you can get some really complex interrelationships, chemical interrelationships, I guess you would say, between the hot water, between the groundwater, rather, and the hot lava, and even the rock that it's in. So you can get different compounds in the water. And if you can measure all that, you can learn a lot about what's going on. And for, I think, obvious reasons, the more you know about the volcanic activity and what's happening underground, the better off you are, particularly in an area that's so active, as is the case here in Hawaii.
What happens when water and lava meet is it causes a sudden condensation of the lava, cooling it off, baking it rock, and that leaves off very noxious gases and can create all sorts of other problems. So it is understandable why they want to measure what the groundwater is and how it's going to affect the lava. The Hawaiian Volcano Observatory is part of the U.S. Geological Survey's Volcano Hazards Program, and their job is to monitor, investigate, and assess hazards from active volcanoes and earthquakes in Hawaii. Communicate the results of this work to the public, emergency managers, and scientific community. Hawaii is an active volcano group, but that information is being able to use for other volcanoes, like we had Mount St. Helens here in the continental U.S. It was established in 1912, the first of five volcano observatories supported by the USGS today, and the UAS unoccupied aircraft systems, or UASs. We have a video that we'll show you of them using the UASs to perform these samples.
In a lot of references to UAS, the USGS, the U.S. Geological Survey, uses unoccupied aircraft systems instead of unmanned. I just thought that was kind of interesting. You see that reference in a lot of places on the website. But this video that David mentioned is spectacular. I mean, I think we've probably all seen videos of volcanic eruptions, and they're pretty dramatic. This particular video is one filmed at night, and the colors and the lava flowing it's beautiful. It really is. Not that you'd want to get very close to it. And one of the things that really surprised me was the speed of the flow. When I've seen lava flowing in the past, it's been kind of slowly moving along, or even creeping at a really slow pace. But the view of this particular eruption, I guess you'd call it, from the drone, it really shows you the speed with which, the velocity with which some of this stuff the lava flows out of the ground. It's just really an awesome video. So they have a number of them. The one that we'll put in the show notes is just a sample. The USGS has many, many more videos that you can locate and enjoy.
Well, we haven't had your grounded file in a while, but
and I like this one.
Evidently, there's a new way to lose money in Las Vegas. What do you think, Bax?
Yeah, this was from dronedj.com. Drone pilot fined $20,000 after flyaway DJI Phantom 3 lands at McCarran Airport in Las Vegas.
It took place in June of 2018, but the man wanted to take a photo of a Ferris wheel. He lost control of his Phantom 3, which drifted for more than 2 miles to the airport and landed. This is not good if your comeback to home is your local international airport.
Yeah, there's some things about this that, I don't know, it doesn't seem like it all hangs together. But after this drone landed next to an active runway, the FAA identified the pilot, except that wasn't easy. The drone did have a registration number on it, but it was an invalid number. It didn't match anything. And for some reason, the folks at the FAA thought to start transposing some of the numbers in the registration. And when they did that, they got a hit. And that was how they were able to identify the pilot of this. And he was given a $14,700 fine by the FAA. But after a period of time, he didn't pay the fine. He didn't take advantage of a process of appealing the fine. And so what did they do? Well, they upped it, and now he owes $20,000.
The Fox affiliate said to the Post, "I started losing GPS. When I lost control of it, it started acting all weird, and it just took off. And I never gave me an opportunity to make any type of adjustments." On the DJI forum, Barkajia said, quote, "I took off an 8-story parking structure. I was flying at 334 feet, had 8 satellites with good reception. I've done this exact flight path before with no issues. I use the RTH a lot, otherwise known as return to home. I usually fly my drone out really far to capture nice shots and always confident that it returns to me, and always does, except I was caught off guard by the new home position. Not realizing my drone was landing almost a mile away caused me to lose drone. My error, but if I only knew drone did the reset of the home point, I would have been ready for it. So I figured out the best is not to tell others so it don't happen to you. I thought once at home point was set, it was set. Well, it's not." Well, okay. If you're flying off a parking garage in Las Vegas, I guarantee you, you're flying within the perimeter of the no-fly zone for McCarran, not to mention Nellis. They're pretty much on top of the Las Vegas Strip.
It's hard to find an excuse for this. Plus the fact that this guy, in different statements to the Fox TV affiliate, to the DJI forum, and some other places, I don't know, the story, it sounds a little bit different each time. So that's a little suspicious to me. But he's in trouble. The FAA, when it initiated this, sent him a registered letter and indicated 9 violations, including flying a drone without permission. So I'm not sure what that's about, but flying in controlled airspace, flying over people, and imposing a hazard to other aircraft. So we'll see what happens. The collection of this fine, it's now apparently in the hands of the U.S. Treasury Department. And what they do in a case like this is look to see if there's any money owed to this individual from the government, such as if he's collecting Social Security benefits or refunds on income tax returns. And the Treasury Department will grab the money out of there. If there's none of that, I don't know what happens next. But I think this guy is in kind of more than a little bit of hot water.
I'm sure they can garnish his wages.
Oh, yeah, there's that too. So this is getting very expensive.
So people, don't be stupid. Just enjoy flying your drones, but do it right. This is just not good. Though it does bring up something, Max. One of the things I was thinking about is drone registration, you know, and here we have, and I'm going to give the guy the benefit of the doubt. I don't think he would deliberately mess up the numbers. Well, he might have, but I don't think he's this smart enough to do this, to mess up the numbers on the drone, the match's registration. It could have been just a accidental reversal. It was very clever of the FAA to start doing some permutations of those numbers to locate the registration.
Yeah, I mean, I've certainly transposed numbers in the past, so that could be a legitimate error on his part. One other note is, if you're really interested in taking a close look at this, this article actually has a link to the original flight logs from the DJI Phantom 3. So if you really want to dig into it, you know, I think it's a CSV file that's up there. And presumably, if you download this, it's not coming to you from some Chinese server.
Ah, ha, ha. Well, Max, I got to finish baking. And I know that you're going to start a road trip down to your home. So I think maybe we'll wrap this up for the week. What do you think?
Yes, we will. And we want to thank all of you for listening to, well, the UAV Digest in general, but also to this episode specifically. If you want to find us, we're at the UAVdigest.com. Show notes for this episode are at that same site, but if you want to go directly to this episode, look for that at the UAVdigest.com/309.
And of course, we want you to become part of our Slack listener team. You can do that by sending us an email to feedback@theuavdigest.com. You can find us on Twitter @UAVdigest, on Facebook @facebook.com/theuavdigest. You can purchase some swag. And of course, please do check out our website for upcoming conventions and events. And if you have a convention or an event coming up and you'd like some international or national exposure, definitely email Max and I, and we will try to get it on our website and promote it for you. So with that, I'm going to say happy Thanksgiving. Both Max and I are very thankful for you listening this year, and I'm going to say thanks for listening. This is David in Fort Washington.
And Max in Hartford.
And we're out.